Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, February 19th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. In one of his first major foreign policy speeches in office, President Joe Biden telling the Munich Security Conference that America is back and promising to rebuild trust with European allies by working together on issues such as the coronavirus, climate change, and arms control. Today, also the first day, the U.S. officially rejoins the Paris Climate Accord. Special Presidential Envoy John Kerry telling the Munich conference, this is a national security issue. Winter storms in the U.S. hindering distribution of coronavirus vaccines. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Andy Slavitt explains the impact and how it's being addressed. And Texas Governor Greg Abbott on the latest power outages in the state due to the cold and the snow, and now it is affecting whether people have running water. From ABC News, President Joe Biden telling European allies on Friday that America is back, repudiating former President Donald Trump's nationalist approach to the world. Biden aiming to restore the U.S.'s place on the global stage after what he views as its absence during Trump's years in office.
For decades, as you pointed out, I participated in the Munich Security Conference. As a U.S. senator, joining my colleagues from both sides of the aisle to affirm the importance of the transatlantic partnership. Three times as Vice President of the United States, including delivering the first international foreign policy address of the Obama-Biden administration in the first months we were in office. And 2 years ago, as you pointed out, when I last spoke in Munich, I was a private citizen. I was a professor, not an elected official. But I said at that time, we will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back. The transatlantic alliance is back. And we are not looking backward. We are looking forward together. It comes down to this. The transatlantic alliance is a strong foundation. The strong foundation on which our collective security and our shared prosperity are built. The partnership between Europe and the United States, in my view, is and must remain the cornerstone of all that we hope to accomplish in the 21st century.
President Joe Biden at the White House speaking virtually to the Munich Security Conference, which is held an annual conference on international security policy in Munich, Germany, since 1963. As he mentioned, he twice attended when he was vice president under President Obama and again in 2019, but this is the first time a sitting U.S. president has spoken to the conference. More from today's speech.
And in so many places, including in Europe and the United States, democratic progress is under assault. I've known many of you for a long, long time, and you know that I speak my mind. So let me be very straightforward with you all. We are in the midst of a fundamental debate about the future and direction of our world. We're at an inflection point. Between those who argue that given all the challenges we face, from the fourth industrial revolution to the global pandemic, that autocracy is the best way forward, they argue. And those who understand that democracy is essential to meeting these challenges. Historians are going to examine and write about this moment as an inflection point, as I said. And I believe that every ounce of my being that democracy will and must prevail. We must demonstrate that democracy can still deliver for our people in this changed world. That, in my view, is our galvanizing mission. Democracy doesn't happen by accident. We have to defend it, fight for it, strengthen it, renew it. We have to prove that our model isn't a relic of history. It's the single best way to revitalize the promise of our future. And if we work together with our democratic partners with strength and confidence, I know we'll meet every challenge and outpace every challenger.
President Biden's speech to the Munich Security Conference, part of what the White House called a virtual tour of Europe. today. President also meeting virtually with the leaders of the world's major industrialized nations, the G7 summit, telling them the U.S. will give $4 billion to COVAX, the international program to get coronavirus vaccines to poorer countries, something that former President Donald Trump chose not to join. Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying this week the U.S. is ready to join talks with Iran and world powers to discuss a return to the 2015 nuclear deal. Biden administration also reversing former President Trump's determination that all U.S. sanctions against Iran had been restored, the so-called snapback. State Department spokesman Ned Price asked today about this by Associated Press reporter Matt Lee. This was a telephone briefing.
In the letter that was sent to the UN and also in the call, you guys didn't explain, although I don't think you were asked, but I would like you to ask now to explain why it is that you guys withdrew the September decisions by the previous administration. Was it because that you agreed with the opponents, which is most of the world, that the previous the United States under the previous administration did not have standing to invoke snapback, or was it that you did not think or you don't think that Iran is in significant non-performance with its obligations under the JCPOA, or is it a combination of both? And then related to that, because of the withdrawal, does that mean that you guys are okay with countries, say Russia, China, others, buying and selling weapons from Iran? Because in withdrawing snapback, that means that the arms embargo that was supposed to expire, which, remember, was the proximate cause for the previous administration's decision to invoke it in the first place, withdrawing it means that that embargo is lifted. Thank you.
Well, thanks for that question, Matt. Let me start with one of the final elements first, and I will say to that, regardless of the UN's Iran sanctions architecture, we will continue to use our authorities to dissuade countries from providing arms to Iran. So there is certainly no change in our posture there at all. When it comes to are the UN actions that were undertaken yesterday, let me just say a couple broad words. The steps we took were intended to remove unnecessary obstacles to diplomacy. We removed recent restrictions on domestic travel for Iranian representatives at the UN, and we're providing written notification to the Security Council that the United States no longer assesses the snapback of Iran-related UNSCRs has occurred. By reversing the previous administration's imposition of additional movement restrictions on Iranian representatives, we are bringing domestic travel controls on Iranian representatives back in line with those on several other missions to the UN. This is indeed a return to our longstanding posture with regards to domestic travel of Iranian representatives to the UN. Now, when it comes to snapback, as you know, Matt, was designed to help ensure Iran performed its JCPOA commitments. At present, no other members of the Security Council agree that previously terminated provisions of prior resolutions, in fact, snapped back in December, despite the position of the previous administration. When we were out of step with the other members of the Security Council, that deadlock weakened our ability to address Iran's destabilizing activities. And reversing our snapback position, we calculated, would strengthen our ability to engage with the Security Council and with our closest allies and partners around the world on Iran. Indeed, reversing our snapback position, it strengthens our ability to engage with the Security Council on Iran, given that no other Security Council member agreed that snapback had occurred. So once again, we are on the same page with our close allies and our close partners with the steps that we took yesterday.
State Department spokesman Ned Price in a teleconference with reporters today. The administration has said that it would accept an invitation from the European Union to attend a meeting of the participants, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council in Germany, along with Iran, in the original nuclear agreement to start up talks again for the U.S. rejoining. Such an invitation has not yet been issued, but one is expected shortly. Secretary of State Antony Blinken did talk this week with the foreign ministers of Great Britain, France, and Germany. On Afghanistan, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin saying progress towards peace and an end to U.S. military involvement there depends on the Taliban reducing attacks. And he says right now, clearly, violence is too high. Secretary Austin held his first news conference as secretary today in the Pentagon.
With respect to Afghanistan, I walked our allies through our thinking as the new administration comes to grips with the reality on the ground. The bottom line is this. We are committed to a responsible and sustainable end to this war while preventing Afghanistan from becoming a safe haven for terrorist groups and that threaten the interests of the United States and our allies, and ensuring a just and durable end to the long-running conflict. And so to that end, we are conducting a rigorous interagency review of the situation, including all relevant options, with full consideration of the consequences of any potential course of action. We are mindful of the looming deadlines, but we want to do this methodically and deliberately. And I certainly won't get ahead of any decisions, nor will I preview the advice that I plan to give to the president. Clearly, the violence is too high right now, and more progress needs to be made in the Afghan-led negotiations. And so I urge all parties to choose the path towards peace. And the violence must decrease now. I told our allies that no matter what the outcome of our review, the United States will not undertake a hasty or disorderly withdrawal from Afghanistan that puts their forces or the alliance's reputation at risk. At this time, no decisions about our future force posture have been made. In the meantime, current missions will continue, and of course, commanders have the right and the responsibility to defend themselves and their Afghan partners against attack. As we move forward in our review, we will consult with our NATO allies, our resolute support partners, and of course, the government of Afghanistan, and there will be no surprises. We will consult each other and consult together and decide together and act together.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the Pentagon. He's a retired four-star Army general who commanded U.S. forces in Afghanistan and across the Middle East for 3 years. During the Barack Obama presidential administration, U.S. troops have been fighting in Afghanistan for 20 years. There are currently about 2,500 there now. The U.S. officially rejoining the Paris Climate Accord today, 30 days after President Biden, in his first day in office, signed an executive order that started the process of reversing former President Trump's withdrawal from the agreement in 2020. The U.S. so far the only country out of nearly 200 signatories to withdraw and now rejoin. John Kerry, U.S. Special Presidential Envoy on Climate, telling the Munich Security Conference today that this is a national security issue.
Climate change, as we just heard from Jens Stoltenberg, is a security issue. And the fact is, it's among the most complex security issues we've ever faced. What we do or don't do in the coming months and years will make all the difference. But for millions of people, Wolfgang, they don't have to look into a distant future to see the impacts of climate change now. They just have to look out the window. This week in the state of Texas, we've seen unprecedented extreme cold related to climate because the polar vortex penetrates further south because of the weakening of the jet stream related to warming. Last year, the U.S. saw a record 30 named tropical cyclones. Europe is warming even faster than the global average. And the melting Arctic ice has changed geostrategic and military calculations for every country on the planet, from Russia to China, and obviously for NATO. And what these extreme weather events translate to on the ground should concern every single one of us. Climate change is, again, as Jens said, it's a threat multiplier. when tensions are already high somewhere and resources are increasingly scarce, the embers of conflict just burn brighter. And when farmers can no longer make a living because the weather is so extreme and unpredictable, they become increasingly desperate. Many, according to some studies, hundreds of millions of people will be forced from their homes, forced from their habitat, from the place they've lived a lifetime. And not only can mass migration drive humanitarian crisis, but as Europe knows only too well, as we saw with Turkey's manipulation of the numbers of people being released and people being pushed out of Syria, if it is not managed well, it can literally begin to undermine countries' homes, peace, and stability. And we've seen dramatic change in politics in a lot of places because of this.
John Kerry, U.S. Special Presidential Envoy on Climate, to the Munich Security Conference today. This from the Associated Press. While Friday's return to the Paris Climate Agreement is heavily symbolic, world leaders say they expect America to prove its seriousness to the issue. They are particularly eager for the U.S. to announce its new national 2030 target for cutting fossil fuel emissions, which scientists agree are altering the Earth's climate and worsening the extremes of drought, hurricanes, flooding, and other natural disasters. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 1, NASDAQ up 9, S&P down 7. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. Senator Joe Manchin saying that he is going to oppose Neera Tanden's nomination to head the White House Budget Office. The Hill newspaper saying it potentially sinks her Senate confirmation. Manchin citing Tanden's harsh tweets about Republicans for the reason of his opposition. Most Republicans already expected to oppose Tanden, and it may be difficult, writes The Hill, for a GOP senator to back her now that Biden will need at least one Republican to support her to get her confirmed. The Senate is divided 50-50 with the parties, Vice President Harris breaking any ties. Virginia State Senator Amanda Chase, staunch supporter of former President Donald Trump, leading the Republican field for governor, according to a poll from Christopher Newport University. Chase has 17%. The next closest candidate is at 10%. Chase was recently censured by Republicans and Democrats in the Virginia State Senate for her attendance at the attack on the U.S. Capitol January 6th. And Prince Harry and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, agreeing with Queen Elizabeth II that they will not be returning as working members of the British royal family. That announcement from Buckingham Palace. President Biden making his first visit to Michigan as president today, touring a Pfizer plant in Portage, just a few miles south of Kalamazoo. Pfizer was the first company granted emergency use authorization in the U.S. for its COVID-19 vaccine. Shipped the first doses in December, expects to make 200 million doses by the end of May. Here is President Biden.
Just over 4 weeks ago, America had no real plan to vaccinate most of the country. My predecessor, as my mother would say, God love him, failed to order enough vaccines, failed to mobilize the effort to administer the shots, failed to set up vaccine centers. That changed the moment we took office. I directed Jeff Zients, my COVID-19 response coordinator, to lead my administration's work with the vaccine manufacturers to buy more vaccines and to speed up delivery. Albert referenced it earlier, and I want to thank him for making it happen. Because we work together, we're now on track to have enough vaccine supply for all Americans by the end of July. It doesn't mean it'll be in all Americans' arms, but enough vaccine will be available by that time. These orders allow facilities like this one to plan ahead, accelerate their production schedules.
President Joe Biden at the Pfizer plant in Michigan. He also called again for Congress to pass his proposed $1.9 trillion stimulus bill. And today, U.S. House Democrats releasing the text of the proposal that they will bring before the Budget Committee on Monday. It includes $1,400 direct checks for Americans making $75,000 a year or less, an extension of $400 federal unemployment benefits, more money for struggling small businesses, and an increase in the federal minimum wage. And the House Budget Committee meets Monday to take it up, 1 p.m. Eastern. We will have coverage on C-SPAN 3 television, which you can also listen to on the free C-SPAN radio app. just choose the C-SPAN 3 live stream. President Biden was originally scheduled to visit Michigan on Thursday. The trip was postponed until today due to poor weather in Washington. Severe weather across the country has also hindered distribution of coronavirus vaccines. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Andy Slavitt talking about shipping delays and backlog of doses during a virtual news conference.
As of now, we have a backlog of about 6 million doses due to the weather. All 50 states have been impacted. The 6 million doses represents about 3 days of delayed shipping, and many states have been able to cover some of this delay with existing inventory. So let me first walk you through the situation and then tell you how we, as an entire nation, will have to pull together to get back on track. There are three places along the distribution chain that have been impacted by the weather. First, FedEx, UPS, and McKesson, our logistics and distribution teams, have all faced challenges as workers have been snowed in and unable to get to work to package and ship the vaccines, kits, and the required diluent. Second, road closures have held up delivery of vaccines at different points in the distribution process, between manufacturing sites, to distribution, and to shipping hubs. Third, more than 2,000 vaccine sites are located in areas with power outages, so they're currently unable to receive doses. General Perna's guidance to the team was to ensure safety of personnel, preservation of the vaccines and supplies, and constant communication with the states. Because of 72-hour cold chain constraints, we don't want to ship doses to those locations and have them sitting at a site where they might expire. So the vaccines are sitting safe and sound in our factories and hubs, ready to be shipped out as soon as the weather allows. Now, as weather conditions improve, we're already working to clear this backlog. 1.4 million doses are already in transit today, and we anticipate that all the backlog doses will be delivered within the next week, with most being delivered within the next several days. And we expect we will be able to manage both this backlog and the new production coming online next week. With everybody's hard work and collective effort, we will be able to catch up, but we understand this will mean asking more of people. UPS and FedEx both will support Saturday deliveries tomorrow. We are working with the jurisdictions to see which ones are able to take Saturday deliveries. The packaging plant for Moderna vaccines is just now coming online. Roads are being cleared for the workforce to leave their homes. They are working today through Sunday to package the backlogged orders and will put the vaccines and ancillary supplies on aircraft on Sunday night for Monday through Wednesday delivery. As we get back on track, we're asking states, sites, and vaccinators to help us catch up and to get Americans vaccinated. We know many Americans are awaiting their second dose, and many more their first dose. We're asking vaccine administration sites to extend their hours even further and offer additional appointments and to try to reschedule their vaccinations over the coming days and weeks as significantly more supply arrives.
Andy Slavitt is the White House COVID-19 response coordinator during today's virtual briefing. Some other news about the Pfizer COVID vaccine. The company saying the vaccine does not need to be stored in expensive deep freezers, at least minus 76 degrees Fahrenheit, where it keeps for 6 months. But it can be stored at up to 5 degrees positive Fahrenheit for 2 weeks. A new study of the Pfizer vaccine also finds a single shot may be effective in preventing COVID as opposed to the usual two shots. Dr. Anthony Fauci, chief science advisor to President Biden, asked about this today.
Next, we'll go to Brenda Goodman at WebMD.
Hi. I have a question about dosing. There have been several studies published in the last couple of days, the dosing of the vaccines, that is, that have suggested that just a single dose of the vaccine might be highly effective after about two or three weeks. And I wondered if that had shifted, Dr. Fauci, if it had convinced you that just a single dose of the mRNA vaccines might end up being effective.
Well, if you're referring to the mRNA vaccine, you're probably referring to a recent Israeli study that looked at the mRNA, because the extension of the time in a single dose with AZ has also been discussed. But let me refer and just answer directly your question with the mRNA. We always look at data very carefully and very seriously, and we evaluate it as it evolves. But if you look at the data from the particular study and then go back and look at why we wound up with a prime and a boost, and for Moderna, as you know, that's 28 days, and for Pfizer, it's 21 days. And the reason is, even though you can get a fair degree of, quote, protection after a single dose, it clearly is not durable. We know that. The durability is not as much as the durability that you would get with the boost. Secondly, if you look at the difference between the degree, the intensity of the response after a first dose, and compare it to that of the second dose is 10 times higher in the sense of level of neutralizing antibodies, which is one of the parameters of immunity.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and the chief science advisor to the Biden administration, part of today's White House coronavirus response briefing. This is Washington Today. From the Texas Tribune, Texas's power grid operator said Friday that additional power outages are no longer needed overnight to balance supply and demand. But many Texans are still without power, and millions of people across the state have had their water service disrupted in the aftermath of this week's massive winter storms. Governor Greg Abbott gave an update from Austin mid-afternoon.
To help localities get clean water back in people's homes, TCEQ, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, as of 5 p.m. today, is standing up a phone bank for local water utilities who are unable to get water testing at their contracted labs. This phone bank will connect local facilities with another lab that can test their water quickly. TCEQ has partnered with the EPA to stand up three mobile water testing labs. Also, we are partnering with local river authorities to use their water labs to assist locals with bacteria sampling. And we have partnered with the state of Arkansas to use their labs. And we are also coordinating with larger local labs that have testing availability to help some smaller municipalities. Now, related to water, restoring water to Texans also means helping Texans deal with what may be their largest challenge in the next week, and that is busted water pipes. We cannot emphasize this enough about homeowners and renters being prepared to deal with the consequences of busted water pipes. The major disaster declaration, when approved by the Biden administration, will assist this process, but as I said before, you must first look to your insurance company that covers your property. Along those lines, I urge everybody, whether you're a homeowner or a renter, if you have insurance, be sure you're on the phone today, contacting your insurance provider to make sure that they are working with you to assist you in this process of dealing with busted water pipes. If, however, you're not covered by insurance, we're working both with FEMA under the major disaster declaration to make sure you get funds access to you as quickly as possible, but also in talking to some of the local leaders last night, I know that local leaders are working locally to work on advanced funding of some of these operations.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott today in Austin. He said he spoke with President Joe Biden last night and the president plans to sign an emergency declaration for his state. President Biden also saying he may visit Texas next week, but didn't want the visit to create a burden for officials involved in emergency relief efforts there. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, saying today he plans to honor the late conservative radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh by lowering the state flags. Governor DeSantis was in West Palm Beach, which is where Limbaugh lived.
Yeah, we had Palm Beach, one of our own, pass away, Rush Limbaugh, this week. And, you know, there's not much needs to be said. The guy was an absolute legend. He was a friend of mine and just a great person. But rather than me get up here and say anything, I thought it would be fitting. Most people know him as Bo Snerdly. We here in South Florida, we know him as James Golden. So I wanted James to come up here. There he is. You've seen it.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, after the remarks by the person he introduced, the governor confirmed he'd be lowering those flags.
I know they're still figuring out the arrangements, but what we do in, when there's things of this magnitude, once the date of internment for Rush is announced, we're going to be lowering the flags to half staff.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Governor.
Governor Ron DeSantis was in West Palm Beach to give a speech about election reform. Rush Limbaugh died this week of lung cancer at the age of 70. This from CNN. After safely landing on the surface of Mars Thursday, NASA's Perseverance rover has sent back a never-before-seen view, what it looks like to land on Mars. Rover also returned some beautiful postcards of its landing site. At a news conference today, the deputy project scientist, Katie Stack Morgan, asked about what some of the terrain features in those first images can tell us about ancient life on Mars.
Next up is Lisa Grossman with Science News. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. This is really exciting. I have a question for Katie that kind of echoes Sarah's question. I want to know more about those porous-looking rocks that are right near the wheel. Do you have any ideas about specifically what those look like? Do they remind you of anything you've seen on Mars before, or are they something totally new? And then I have a follow-up question if we have time after that.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So there are a couple things that we've looked at and thought about already with these rocks. And of course, these are just our first impressions. And so we have many more observations we need to make about these. But when we think about these holes or vugs that we see in the rock, and depending on a sedimentary or volcanic interpretation, these holes or vugs can mean different things. And so having holes like this in a volcanic rock is not uncommon. As a lava solidifies into an actual basaltic rock, gases in that lava can outgas, and that is often what can create holes like that in the rocks, and we call those vesicles. And so it could be, if these are volcanic rocks, that might be what we're seeing. But we also know that in sedimentary rocks, holes like this can form when fluids moving through the rocks actually dissolve some of those rocks away, leaving behind these holes or gaps in the rocks. And so it could be that that's what we're looking at. And so I think really we have to get our instruments out and look at these textures in fine detail to really help us make that determination. And depending on what the origin of these rocks is, these holes can mean different things. And so we're excited to follow up on that and find out really what's going on here.
NASA scientist Katie Stack Morgan on the first images back from the rover Perseverance, which landed on Mars yesterday. The rover plans to collect rock samples and bring them back to Earth, first time that's been done, and also planned testing a 4.5-pound helicopter named Ingenuity for the first powered flight in the thin Martian air. Well, thanks for being with us today on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN radio app to listen to us anywhere and get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcast. You might as well subscribe so you don't miss one. Hope you have a good night and a good weekend.